When it comes to gun violence, there are a lot of differing emotions that drive opinion. But what does the data say? And how can a fact-based data approach actually solve America's gun violence problem? Data scientist Sheldon H. Jacobson, founder, professor of computer science, and director of the Simulation and Optimization Laboratory at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, joins us on the Lucianne Lantz Show. Dr. Jacobson, the July 4th mass shooting at the Independence Day Parade in Highland Park, Illinois, is another example of these mass killings at the hands of apparently disturbed individuals. Mm-hmm. And it makes people think that mass shootings in America happen all of the time. But what does the data say?
Well, one has to make a distinction between what a mass shooting is versus a mass murder. What we just saw in Highland Park was a mass murder, which means at least four people unrelated to the shooter were in fact killed. We saw this happen. It was another heinous incident, but they only happen approximately once every 2 weeks in the United States. Mass shootings, on the other hand, are much more ubiquitous. They occur approximately 5 times every 3 days. So we have to make a distinction. And a mass shooting is simply where a gun is discharged and one or more people is injured or potentially killed. So there's a distinction there.
All right. So you have said that the biggest challenge to the prevention of mass shootings includes the development of accurate models to forecast or predict the effects of new laws, policies, and procedures for addressing the problem. That certainly is something everyone wants to get down to the root of why these occur and how we can actually prevent them from happening in the first place. What are those models you're talking about?
Well, we rely on evidence-based medicine to determine how our physicians are going to treat us. Should we not rely on evidence-based policymaking to do the same? And that's a critical point. People often throw out many different ideas saying we're going to do A, B, and C, and that will have a certain effect. But the fact is, nobody knows, because determining causality and impact is very different. These kinds of models are useful because they help us understand what's going to happen when we make policy changes. And we see this in other fields right now. And a great example is the Transportation Security Administration of how they ensure that we are going to have a safe airspace. In particular, what they do is use layers, and any one layer may be porous, but the collective use of the layers results in a very sturdy system. And the same principles can be applied when it comes to reducing gun violence in the United States.
And I want to point out to our listeners, your work was actually used to develop the Transportation Security Agency's PreCheck, the screening program that makes risk assessments about passengers before they even arrive at an airport checkpoint. So your work is actually being used, but you'd like to see our politicians really understand this as well, because they're making the decisions on these kinds of policies concerning gun safety, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very difficult issue, and there's so many different views, and many people have an ideological view of what we should be doing about gun violence. But the fact is, the data speaks, and it speaks very loudly and clearly. And if we use metaphors from other fields like aviation security, what we realize is that there are ways that we can reduce gun violence by using layers. And any one layer may be porous, but collectively they are very, very sturdy.
And you've described this as Swiss cheese, that when you take different pieces of Swiss cheese, lay it over, as long as you don't line up the holes, you've got it covered. And that's kind of what the idea is here.
Exactly, because we're talking about red flag laws, we're talking about background checks, we're talking about using different techniques that people recognize and talk about, but we can't get agreement on all of them. That's the difficulty. But when you put them all together, you end up with a fairly sturdy system. And although nobody will agree with all of them, collectively, they will provide significant protection.
Dr. Jacobson, how would this work exactly? Because one of the fears is that law-abiding citizens will have their guns taken away, that we will erode the Second Amendment.
And that is completely false. Because one of the issues that I'm very sensitive to, and I've written a lot about this, is that we don't want to remove firearms from the vast majority of people who use it for recreation, who use it for hunting, who use it for self-defense. We don't want to take it away from them. But at the same time, we want to prevent people who are going to use it for egregious actions, bad actors, so to speak, will harm the system. We want to get it away from those people. So how do we discern that. And this comes down to an issue which we're familiar with called the false alarm, false clear trade-off. We don't want to have people who really can use the guns responsibly not have access to the firearms, but at the same time, the people who are more of a potential threat, we want to keep them away from them. And that's the challenge.
So what does the data say in how we do that best?
And we do that by creating layers. Any responsible gun owner wants to have access to their firearms, and all of these layers will not prevent them from having that. But any one layer may be a red flag for them, but it can be easily resolved. It's when you look at a person who has a history of violence, who may have some kind of emotional issues which have caused problems society for them. They may be young, and when you match up what they're requesting in firearms with what they actually need it for, you realize there's a mismatch. These are when significant number of red flags start to appear. Each of these layers is basically raising a concern. Collectively, they say there's a problem. Any one layer may be a flag for a responsible gun owner, but that's not going to be enough to prevent them from having a firearm.
Dr. Jacobson is a member of INFORMS. This is a worldwide organization for the decision and data sciences made up of professionals and students. And very scientific in the work that goes into the members of that organization. I want to talk a little bit more, though, in layman's persons on what this would look like. Could you give some examples of what needs to happen in order for these data-driven solutions to be implemented to hopefully counteract against these kinds of activities?
Sure. The recent legislation, which you look at, which was signed in by President Biden, is not going to produce very much of a benefit. But what it did is it began a dialogue between two groups of people who are diametrically opposed on this particular issue. And we have comparable issues that are coming up right now in the discussion about abortion rights. There's so many of these. And we get people who are so far apart, they won't even talk. They won't even get in the same room. What we need to do is bring them together and find out what is common. And what's common is the objective. The objective is reducing gun violence. Nobody, whether you're a gun owner or not a gun owner, wants gun violence. And we don't want violence, and we don't want unnecessary deaths. But here's the thing that people don't realize, is that the vast majority of deaths that are due to firearms are actually suicides. People inflicting harm on themselves. That's over 50% of the gun deaths in this country, which runs around 45,000 people every year. So when you start to look at the objective and work backwards, you start to get agreement of what is possible. And that's where we begin the dialogue. Then we start to throw out the different layers. And some will never agree. But there will be some layers that people can agree for. Education, for example, safe storage of firearms is critical. People can agree on those kinds of things, and we work from there. That's the process we need to follow.
Give an example of other layers that need to be melded together to make this happen.
Okay. Ammunition. Ammunition is a great example because we often think, oh, guns are the cause, but you can't cause harm unless you have ammunition, which means that if someone is requesting 2,000 rounds of ammunition and they're 19 years old and they've never owned a gun before, so this is their first gun, that of itself is an issue of concern. A lot of it funnels back to the red flag issues, that are we in fact seeing something that is an anomaly? The other thing is, if we look at people who are harming themselves or others, there are certain characteristics in their life that we can then point to and saying, okay, are these characteristics are occurring sufficiently that we need to have a concern when a person with those characteristics starts to request large amount of ammunition with a very powerful weapon? What's your purpose of doing that? Once again, if there's no, for no better choice of word, a silver bullet here. There's no one solution that is going to solve the problem. And it's not going to be simple, but it's going to be a collective set of layers that groups can agree upon so that the Second Amendment rights are preserved, but at the same time, you reduce gun violence. Are you going to bring it down to zero? I'd like to say yes, but reality is that we aren't. But with enough layers, we can reduce it significantly that it becomes much less significant in the minds of people.
We're talking about taking a data approach to solving America's gun violence problem. You're listening to Ann Arbor's Talk Station 1290 WLBY. Our guest is Dr. Sheldon Howard Jacobson. He is a founder professor of computer science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. What does the data show in regards to mental health and approaches maybe that can be taken in that direction? Is that studied as well?
Well, when you look at the people who are, in fact, inflicting harm on themselves in particular, but then on others, there is often an issue of mental health issues. But the word mental health, in some sense, is very, very broad, and we have to focus it a little bit more. Are we dealing with mental illness? Are we dealing with emotional difficulties and the stresses of life? And if we separate those two, it becomes much more apparent that it is the more of the latter than the former that we're really concerned about. That people who are causing harm, like we just saw in Highland Park, when we saw in Uvalde, these are people under extreme mental stresses. This is a manifestation of their emotional illness or emotional disease. And in essence, these things need to be treated.
What needs to be happening in Congress in order for some of these solutions you've mentioned to be implemented?
The first thing is we have to have discussions. People aren't even talking to each other. And once again, gun violence, abortion, and other very high-charged issues, it's so difficult to get people to even to talk about them, let alone actually come up with a solution. So before you can run, you have to walk. And before you walk, you may have to crawl. And one of the things that I've advocated for is that we have to focus on what we're trying to achieve. What is the objective? And if you can identify common objectives, maybe you can then identify common pathways to help us get there. But until we even can decide what we're trying to achieve, it's impossible to come up with solutions.
So do you see that happening then with our politicians? Is that where it starts, or does it start somewhere else?
This is a very difficult issue, obviously, and the only solution is for people to come together. You know, often if we think about, you know, September 11th, the country came together in ways that we had never seen before, certainly not before and for many decades, going back even to World War II and other events. National calamities are actually an opportunity as well as an event that we have to deal with from an emotional and a stressful level. But these opportunities don't come very often. And when we start to see what is changing in society in so many ways, we are at the cusp of an opportunity for us to come together. But once again, we see another mass murder, and we're almost insensitive to it after a while. I mean, it's kind of sad because you think, gee, more people are killed. Uvalde, children being killed. People then think that there's some kind of event that it's not even real. I mean, this is surreal that people would even think these things considering the evidence that is put before us. We are at a critical juncture in our nation's well-being for us to move forward together, as opposed to moving apart. And we are moving apart right now, but we have to come together. And I look at data, and I'm not very ideological in my views. So as a result of that, what does the data speak? But data is only a rearview mirror. It only tells us where we've been. I try and use the data to see where we're going to head. And where we're heading can be so much better and so much brighter, but it requires people to talk to each other.
It does. And I think in regards to your example of 9/11, we had a leader, though, who knew how to bring the country together. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's missing right now. We need to set politics aside and be able to talk to each other about these kinds of issues to come to some sense. Also, 9/11 was an attack on the whole country all at once. Yes. These mass shootings or mass murders are piecemeal, and until it hits you home, sometimes it doesn't seem real to a lot of people. What do you say about kind of those differences?
Certainly, people will always look at it through their lens of their own personal experiences. Yes, people were killed in Illinois. People were killed in Texas. People were killed in Ohio. Yet the reality is they weren't killed. They don't know anybody who was killed. And the fact is, what we have to look is much more, I will use the word altruistically, about the fact that we're all in this together. And that if the country doesn't do well, at the end of the day, we're not going to do well individually. And this is something that has been lost. And as I look at data and I see trends, these trends start to speak out. from the fact that there's been some societal shifts over the last several years, going back decades now. We're talking about going back even into the 80s and 70s, that there's been a tremendous shift in society. And as I look at data and I compare them over long horizons, I realize, my goodness, there are things that are happening. But what I don't know is where we're heading from there. That I can't always predict.
So what is that shift that you've seen?
I've seen that there's been changes in just in attitudes, in outlook, and how people are looking at the world. And this is what the data is saying. And when you read polls, in fact, this comes out in the same way. These are some of the data that I looked at. And when I've looked at forecasting for elections, I mean, how much more difficult it is to do that compared to what it was, 15 and 20 years ago when I first started doing this. These are some of the changes that we're seeing. At the end of the day, we have to talk to each other. And we're all in the same country. We're all on the same planet.
Dr. Jacobson, do you think we've become more polarized then in those years you're discussing?
The word that I've heard used to describe it is it's almost tribalism. We've become more bifurcated in different sects. And then we stand by it almost to the point that you're either with us or you're against us.
Exactly.
And the fact is, we don't have to be against someone if we're not with them.
So why do you think we've become that way, though? Does the data show why?
The data tells us we've become that way. It doesn't explain the why. That's the thing, that's the limitations on what the data will tell us. Remember, it's a rearview mirror. It tells us where we've been. It doesn't tell us where we're going. And it doesn't always explain the why.
So what it tells us moving towards the future is, if we don't come together on these issues, if we don't have the respect for each side, if we don't have an ability to be able to discuss these issues, we're never going to come to the answer, are we?
It's going to be more difficult to grasp a solution if we're not willing to engage in a dialogue to inform the process. That's what I think we need to do. Because people, once again, focusing on the outcome is important. What can we agree upon? But then there has to be a process to get there. And part of that process is just people talking to each other. And people aren't talking to each other anymore. And that I find, concerning. It's concerning personally, but it's more concerning for children and grandchildren and the people who are just coming into the world today. This is a great country. I continue to be amazingly optimistic in spite of everything. I really believe that we are heading somewhere fantastic and we have that potential. But the people who are going to destroy it are from within, not the outside. We talk about the threats from the outside. That's not our biggest threat. Our biggest threat is ourselves. Mm. How are we going to come together and make the potential that's possible realized? Because we can be special and we can continue to be that way, but it's going to require some cooperation.
Out of the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, Dr. Sheldon Howard Jacobson, founder, professor of computer science and director of the Simulation and Optimization Laboratory at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. He also is a member of the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences known as INFORMS. Great discussion today. Thank you so much. And hopefully our leaders will be paying attention. I'm Lucy Ann Lance. This is Ann Arbor's Talk Station, 1290 WLBY.